update on what's going on if you're okay. Got it. This will be an update on what's going on with the current solar cycle, number 25. And also, I assume that most hams don't have a real deep knowledge of the solar terminology and what's going on. So talk from a very basic level and try to get you up to speed for those who aren't there yet on some mitigation, whatever. But obviously, it's a big topic and you can spend hours on it. And I'll try to. And I want to also thank Carl, K9LA, for some of his slides and encouragement. If you're interested in learning more about propagation, whatever, CQ has this propagation handbook, and it's on DVD. You can get that through CQ Magazine. It's an excellent series. Anyway, the outline today will talk about basic propagation, the solar cycles, what they are, solar radiation. It's very important to understand how the sun is radiating in order to understand how it affects our ionosphere and just what the ionosphere is. And again, I'll touch on these things, but not in great detail. Hopefully it'll help you have a better appreciation for where we're headed and how to use the information that's so available nowadays to do some real DXing. Give you the update on where we're at in the cycle and the predictions, the models, and some idea of the parameters that we can look at. Okay, so we'll just dive right in here. What is a solar cycle? This is very basic. If we look at the vertical axis, the y-axis, we have a smooth sunspot number. We tend to average them. We'll talk about the actual definition of a sunspot and the number anyway in from a minimum number of sunspots. They can be zero for quite a while, as they were at the end of cycle 24. And they go to a maximum number, these little dark spots on the sun, and then they taper off to back to zero, basically. And the upswing takes about 4 years and the downswing about 7 years. So it's about 11 years on average for a cycle. Now, one cycle can be as short as 8 years, we've seen, and as long as 13 or 14 years. But the average is about 11 years. Let's see. So back in 1610, the guy credited with inventing the telescope, Galileo, made first observations of sunspots. Fortunately, he didn't go blind doing that. He had projected them onto a piece of paper so he could actually see, and he noticed these dark spots. So if you look at the chart in the very bottom right corner, you'll see from 1600, or actually 1610, to almost the present day. It's a little bit out of date, this chart, but you'll see that the sunspots vary in magnitude or in number considerably since they started recording them in 1610. But that 11-year periodicity is very obvious in that cycle or in that time frame. There is also a period down between around 1630 and 1700 where there were no sunspots or very few, and they call it the Maunder minimum. And everyone was predicting that we would be in another month, not everyone, but a lot of people were predicting that we would be in another minimum similar to that at this point, based on the last few cycles. And of course they were wrong, and I'll try to explain a little bit more about the predictions and so on. But because we don't really have a valid physical model of the sun, we can't really predict what's going to happen other than use the statistics of previous cycles. So we're still working on it, but to understand the workings of the sun, where it converts hydrogen into helium by a fusion reaction, is not simple. It's one of the most complicated physics problems we have to solve. And it's not just for our sun, but for all stars. We really don't understand that mechanism. So we use statistics, and it depends. You know, a lot of people, economists use statistics, and they're usually wrong. Scientists like to think they have a better approach to statistics, but can often be wrong as well. So I refer to it as conjecture. And we know we're going to be wrong. The question is, how wrong are we going to be? What are the errors? Okay, so why are the solar cycles important? Well, if you're at the bottom of the cycle, points A or C, you tend to have really good propagation on the longer wavelengths or the lower frequencies. 80 meters, 160 meters tends to be really good. If you're trying to get really good DX, you want to be up near point B, near the solar maximum. So in the higher HF bands, 6 meters through 15 meters, which would include 10, 12, and 15 meter bands, you want to be active during the period at solar max. Is that we have more sunspots. And the sunspots, and this is a key point, a sunspot is a dark spot which is caused by an intersection of the magnetic flux lines resulting in cooler regions of the sun. But around those dark spots, it gives off extreme ultraviolet rays. And I'll talk more about that. But the extreme ultraviolet is what energizes our ionosphere, especially for DX. So the more sunspots, the more EUV radiation, the more we have an energized ionosphere, which means it acts more like a mirror or a reflector of radio waves back to the Earth. And the farther out that mirror extends. So the farther out it is, the farther we have a skip distance for our DX. And I'll show that in more detail in the coming slides. So if we have very few sunspots, then we have fewer disturbances for the ionosphere, and that's what favors the longer wavelengths, the 80 and 160 meters, because they don't penetrate very far into the ionosphere. Okay, this is a kind of a key slide here too. If you look at the solar radiation, the electromagnetic spectrum of the sun, okay, and the wavelength is plotted across the horizontal axis. So it starts out with very short wavelengths on the left and very long wavelengths on the right. Our shortwave radio waves are on the order of what says 10 meters here. Well, we know 10 meters to 160 meters. They're very long wavelength. But they are what we use, but they don't have any impact on the ionosphere. We need an active ionosphere to be able to reflect these short waves back to the Earth. Now notice that the visible light spectrum, 44% of the radiation coming from the sun, almost half is in the visible spectrum. This is why most of our mammalian eyes have developed a very sensitive ability to see in the visible light spectrum. Insects typically see in the ultraviolet, shorter. They're smaller, and they see the shorter wavelengths much more effectively, so they can find the flowers and so on. And if you keep going left, the wavelengths get shorter and shorter and shorter. Those are the extreme ultraviolet, and they are the ones given off by the sunspots, and they are the ones responsible for ionizing our ionosphere. Now, when you think about the ionosphere, think of as you get further away from the Earth, you still got all these gases, oxygen and nitrogen and so on. And they like to be in a stable form. Oxygen likes to be in the form of O2, two atoms of oxygen stuck together, nitrogen the same and so on. So what you need to do to ionize these, you need to break them apart. So you need radiation from the sun. These ultraviolet or extreme ultraviolet rays can do that. They'll break the oxygen into two atoms, separate atoms of oxygen, each one with a charge. So that's a key point. And I like to use an analogy here. The photon energy, I say here, is proportional to the frequency. In other words, the higher the frequency, which means you're moving to the left in this, the more energy those photons or electromagnetic particles or waves have. Now, if you have a friend, you're in the park and you have a long rope, and your friend goes to the other end of the rope, let's say it's 20 feet long, and you start, he just holds it, and you start waving your end up and down, you'll get a long wavelength on that thing. But if you start moving it faster and faster up and down, you can make the wavelength go shorter and shorter, higher frequency. And so that takes more energy. So that's why you need these very, very short wavelength particles or EM waves to energize the particles in the ionosphere. It has to be very energetic. So visible light's not going to do it. Ultraviolet is not going to do it. It needs to be in the extreme ultraviolet. And that's where these sunspots come in. Okay, so we have regions around the Earth, three regions. Initially, about 100 years ago, when they first started noticing that some of the wave energy sent out from radio transmitters was being reflected back to Earth, they figured out that there must be some kind of electric field in order to do that, to interfere and send it back. So they call it the electric field region, or the E region. And later on, they figured out that there was even a further region. So because we had the E region, they called it the F region. And later still, they noticed that some of these waves were being absorbed, and that absorption layer was even closer to the Earth. So they call it the D region. So there's no A, B, or C region. There's just the E and F. And the D region forms only during the day, during the sunlight. And it is responsible for absorbing a lot of radio waves. And if you get big solar flares, the X-ray radiation from the solar flares can strengthen the D region, and we get a reduction in our ability to get through the D region into the E and F. The F region forms during the day and breaks into two layers, the F1 and F2, all the way out to about 400 kilometers from the Earth. And if you're, let's say you're standing here in Europe and you want to contact Asia, well, if you go only to the F1 layer, you may bounce here and may not get very far into Asia. But if you can start in Europe and hit the F2 layer, then you'll go farther out and farther back, and you may hit your target. So the more sunspots you have, the more extreme ultraviolet radiation is created, the thicker this F region, the farther out it goes, the better the DX. So during, and I need to point out that as you go up in frequency, so from 14 megahertz or the 20 meter band may bounce off the lower part of F2, but if you keep going to 21 megahertz, the 15 meter band, you may penetrate further. If you go to 10 meters and hit the outer edges of the F2 layer, you'll get even further. That's why 10 meter DXing is so much better if 10 meters is open, because you get on one skip a much farther distance. During the night, the D region disappears entirely. And so you tend to get a really good DX at night because there's no absorption, but the F region combines into only one layer. So it tends not to be open on 10 meters at night, because it's not extending as far out from the Earth as it would during the day. These can all be variable. During the peak of the cycle, we've heard, and there's many people that have experienced it, some of the old timers, where 10 meters was open all day and all night. So with enough radiation, you can get the F2 existing all night long as well. We have a concept called the maximum usable frequency, or MUF, and I'll talk about it here. So if you're on at point A on the Earth and someone else, a receiver, is at point B and you want to contact them, if you're using a frequency that is greater than the maximum usable frequency, It'll go right through the ionosphere and into space, go on forever. If you're less than or equal to the maximum usable frequency, then it will come back down to Earth and bounce. And most of the really good DX is when you are able to find out what that MUF is and operate just slightly below it. And that MUF will vary during the day. Okay, so, and during this cycle, as we're, and we're right about, I would say, two-thirds of the way up from A to B right now, that's the quietest time of the solar cycle in terms of disturbances that can the sun can create. It's a two-edged sword because the sun is gaining in sunspots, but it's also having more solar storms. And there's basically three kinds of storms that it can have. It can have what are called coronal mass ejections. In other words, there's particles that are caught up in a magnetic field, and the magnetic field crosses with other flux lines, and poof, this big burst of particles gets ejected from the sun. And if it's aimed at the Earth, which is not, it isn't always aimed at us, but if it is, it can cause a huge disturbance. And some of these CMEs can cause radio blackouts and all kinds of other things. Power line damage we saw in Quebec years ago. The good thing about CMEs is they're actual particles coming, and we can predict them as they have a certain speed, up to 1,000 kilometers per second, and they may take anywhere from 3 to 4 days to get here. So we have notice, and you'll see some forecasts and models. Another thing that can happen from the sun is a coronal hole. That's where the flux lines of the magnetic field of the sun cross, and they form what are called holes. It looks like a darker region on the sun, and the solar wind is no longer held around the sun. It comes out, and if it's facing the Earth, then we get a very high-speed solar wind, and that impacts our Earth's shield, our magnetic field of our own, called the magnetosphere. And if the high-speed solar wind hits us in a certain way, then it gets carried away, and it's no big deal. But if it's opposite to the Earth's magnetic field, then it can cause aurora. So we can get coronal mass ejections, we can get aurora any time of the cycle, actually, but it's most prevalent during when you're getting closer to the solar maximum. And then there's flares. And these are just storms that erupt on the surface, and they give off X-rays. And the more X-rays, the more they can affect the D region, and we get absorption. Last week, I was in a contest doing the WPX. We had major solar flare, and the absorption index, we call the A index, was up to 24, which was very high. Up in near Edmonton, it was horrible. That and the thunderstorms in the region, and we decided to pull the plug 6 hours early before the end of the contest. So these large flares and CMEs are most prevalent around the solar maximum, but they can occur. Getting on to predicting the solar weather, we talk about the solar flux index. Now, solar flux just refers to the particles or the solar wind coming to the Earth, how much or how many particles pass through 1 square meter, like if you had a hula hoop, per second. So the more you have, higher the solar flux suggests that you're going to be ionizing more of the F layer. So we like high solar flux. And it varies from about 65 all the way to 250. That's sort of the scale of the solar flux. And we don't have daily forecasts. So, and that's because of two factors. We have the K index, which is a measurement of the departure from the normal magnetic field of the Earth, and that varies around the Earth. And that goes from 0 to 10 on a scale, where 10 is the worst, 0 is there's no departure from normal. You can actually measure it yourself if you build a magnetometer, and there's all kinds of stuff to on the internet to help you build that if you want, or you can just get it off the internet. And then there's also something called tropospheric coupling. The troposphere is the lower, one of the lowermost layers around the Earth, and is responsible for our weather. So thunderstorms, hurricanes, all that stuff, they've discovered in the last 10 years or so, it's a big new field of investigation. It actually affects our ionosphere as well. The lower part of the ionosphere is in the upper part of the troposphere, if that makes sense. And so these things called gravity waves are propagating up from thunderstorms into the ionosphere and can ruin our predictions for solar flux as well. So what we do is we have a monthly prediction, a median prediction, a 50% probability. It's going to be either better than this or not so good as this. And so we can get a monthly prediction of what the solar flux is going to be. And NOAA, the US government's prediction, is published every month. And the 27-day forecast, the reason for 27 days is it takes the sun on average 27 days to rotate once about its own axis. So if there's a sunspot facing us now, chances are if it's still active, it'll come back in 27 days if it lasts that long. And so the weather, the solar weather right now, you can predict with some degree of accuracy that it's going to be the same 27 days from now. But of course, the sun never really stays the same that long. So we have our K index and our A index, and we get predictions on those. And you can see this was a forecast here. The K index is published every 3 hours. And the A index is an average over one full day or 8 3-hour periods. And the A index is a pretty good indicator of how much the D layer is absorbing our radio waves. You don't want it double digits. All right, so as far as forecasts of solar cycles, I'll show you how extremely scientific approach I took to predicting my own. I did this in 2016 to predict where we should be in cycle 25 right now, or at any time in cycle 25. In other words, how high it was going to be. Is it going to be lower? Is it going to be higher? And this chart here shows the cycles from, and this is a smooth sunspot number, from 1700 to pretty much the present day, and or what I had, I think, as of 2016 or 18. And so what I did is I said, well, look, every cycle is different from the previous one. What's the average difference? And when I calculated that out, it was about 30%. Some are more than 30% higher or lower, but on average, from one cycle to the next, they're either about a third higher or a third lower. Okay, now what happens between cycles? Well, if you look at the first three cycles here, we start out at the first cycle. This is cycle one. Cycle two is higher than cycle one. Cycle three is higher than cycle two. So I put two red arrows because they're higher. Then they start decreasing. So I put green arrows when they decrease. So you notice there's two up, three down, two up, three down, two up, two down, and so on. Well, if you look at cycles 21, 2, 3, and 4, then you see that there's three down in a row. Well, we've never seen four down in a row since 1700. So I said the odds of it going to a fourth, even smaller, are very, very small. So I predicted it's going to be 30% higher because that's the average change, and it's going to go up. That was how scientific I got in the production or in the prediction of cycle 25. Now, Carl, in his talks, he refers to cycle 21 as a large, sort of like a t-shirt size. You got a large, medium, and small. So the large one was cycle 21. If we could go back to 1980-ish, we'd all be really happy with the DX, as we had a very large cycle, not necessarily the largest. That was active back then. We'll tell you, you could use a wet noodle for an antenna on 10 meter and work the world all day long. So that was the best one we've ever had. But we call 21 a large, 23 a medium, and the last one we've had, in the last cycle, a small. And we'll use those terms in some of the next plots. Okay, and just as an aside, if you've been licensed for less than 5 years or so, people have been telling you, oh, just wait till the solar maximum, it's going to get great. Well, the wait is over. That's the good news here. We should. And I'll tell you, last night I was on 15 meters, and I'll show you some of the results. And also 6 meters. I worked 6 new states last night. So it's all good. So again, if we want to see and put the current information of cycle 25 relative to the small, medium, and large, well, here's the large, cycle 21. This is what it did in terms of sunspot numbers. And we start the plot from the start of the cycle. So these are months after the start of the cycle on the horizontal axis. And again, thank Carl for this. This is the last update I had, was April 1st from him. But so there's the blue curve, which is the maximum cycle 21. Then we had the small, which was our last cycle, and the medium one was cycle 23 in between. Well, we started out kind of following cycle 24, the small, but suddenly we got really steep and we're climbing, and maybe even faster than we've seen in many, many years. It could be the same rate of climb as we had in cycle 21 and may outperform cycle 23. So where we're going looks like a very steep curve and could be really, really good. And I've also got another story to tell you about why some of the scientific world is extremely hopeful that this might even be the biggest cycle we've ever seen. Okay, the next 6 months, though, we're going to find out just what happens to this this steep curve. Now, if you look at NOAA or NASA's website, they're already throwing up the white flag, giving up, because their prediction, which is the red curve here, and the left chart is in terms of sunspot number, the right chart is in terms of solar flux, and they're both very wrong. So in terms of sunspot number, we should be, according to their chart, 37.1 as a monthly average. They're, but the measurements are saying we're at 84.1. So we're more than double what the sunspot numbers should be. In fact, they've been wrong now 19 straight months in a row. So we like to enjoy the fact that the experts are wrong again. If you look at solar flux, which is something we actually measure, it's not quite as dramatic, but actually you'll see that it is, and some other ways of representing the numbers. We should be around 84.5 solar flux units, and we're over 130. So it's really steep. And look how steep this curve is climbing compared to the previous cycle 24. So we're almost to the peak, the average peak of cycle 24. So we're doing great this cycle. And if you've been on the air at all, you've probably heard some of these big openings. Now, this is my my charting. I've been charting this for years. Every few days, I update my Excel spreadsheet with the bunch of different things. The red curve on top is an index. I had a paper published in QEX magazine last year, I think March, April of last year, on what's called the MG2 index. It's another index that I realized was very important. And nobody was using for monitoring the extreme ultraviolet of the sun. And if you look at the MG2 index, it's already peaking around the peak of solar cycle 24. Not quite to 23 yet, but we're still 2 years supposedly from the peak. So this has got a ways to go. We could even beat cycle 22 or 21, which is the large cycle here. So we're doing well. The blue curve below it is the solar flux. And even that, you can see the steep rise here is better than the steep rivals some of the other ones. It looks more like this one in 22. So both the solar flux and the MG2 index are really doing well and telling us that we're ahead of the game by at least a couple of years. So how are the bands doing? Well, if you've been on at all, we've had a lot of openings during the spring, and we've had a little bit of a quiescent period the last couple of weeks, but that was due to some storms. If you're on the air, even at northern latitudes like I am, 10 meters, 12 meters has been open a lot. 15 and 17 seem like 20 meters used to. They're longer. And last night I was on 15 meters at 10 p.m. and I worked Pakistan on FT8, and I've only worked Pakistan once before in my life. That was in 2015 on CW. So it was amazing. I'll show you a PSK reporter plot of what I was lighting up last night. So the bands, time to get on, guys, if you're into DXing. The low bands, they suffer during the period where you're active with all the sunspots. So 160, I wouldn't necessarily recommend, although there are still the odd opening. Okay, so if you're going to be checking out the various indices, if you're on QRZ.com, a lot of us use that, you can see the solar flux index, which is, this was from a year ago or 9 months ago, but right now it's over 100, the solar flux index, the sunspot number is here, and the maximum usable frequency is given somewhere on here. And there it is, 22. So if you're you want to operate 15 meters, because 21 megahertz is just below the MUF, and that would probably be your best DX band at the time. It's also got the K index, which was 2.7. It can't be, no, 2. The K index was 2 here, so that's okay. Anything 3 or less is probably not so bad. The BZ is the magnetic field of the solar wind as it faces the Earth. You'd like it to be positive or very minimally negative. If it's strongly negative, then that means aurora conditions. And the solar wind speed, you want it to be around 400 or less. If it gets to be above 500, then chances are your K index is high and you're not going to be hearing much either. So there's a chart which kind of outlines some of those values. Now, this was as of last night. I pulled these off of, if you go to solarham.net, it's sort of a one-stop shopping for all these different indices and so on. Solar flux was 101, gives you sunspot number value, and the areas, they sum up all the sunspots in terms of area. I don't pay attention to that. I mostly look at this solar flux number. 101 isn't, I mean, it's not bad. We spent many years near solar minimum where it was in the 70s and 80s, and we were waiting and waiting for it to break 100. Well, we've had as high as 100, I think 168 or 173 recently before it came back down slightly below 100. Now it's on its way back up. And if you look at the 3-day geomagnetic forecast, again, and they break it out for high and medium latitudes. So for today, they're saying it should be pretty good. A G0 value means there's no geomagnetic storms forecast. And if you look at the K index, or the planetary K index, they average 13 different stations around the world. We're around 1, which is perfect. That's why last night it was so quiet magnetically that we're able to work so much DX. This is great. When there's storms, this gets way up into 3 and 4, it turns yellow, turns red. It's yellow above 3 and it's red above, I think 5 or maybe 6. And then there's the aurora oval. So not too bad. It's staying pretty much as it rotates around the very highest latitudes. Again, these solar flares, they emit X-rays, and these A, B, C, M, and X scale, those are logarithmic. So B is 10 times as strong as an A, C is 10 times as strong as a B. It's sort of like the Richter scale with earthquakes. It's a logarithmic scale too. So we're just chugging along with very few solar flares right now. And the key, one of the key indices I look at is the wind speed, the solar wind. If it's 400, it's pretty good. This is actually down around 300, which is really, really slow. Again, that's why the K index was so low, around one, and why things are so quiet. And even 160 or an 80 might have been good last night. I didn't check them because you like that to be around 300 to 350 for good conditions on the top band. So just looking at other ways of seeing what's open, there's DX maps, if you're familiar with that. There's also this real-time propagation, the MUF map, maximum usable frequencies. If you go to prop.kc2g.com, there's contoured values, and inside the little bubble, there's a number. It'll tell you what the actual MUF at that location is. So if you want to work a station from Manitoba to Europe, you have to see what the lowest MUF number contour you're going to cross. And if it's 12, then you don't want to be on 20 meters because that's 14 megahertz. You want to be maybe on 30 meters, which would be 10 megahertz, or 40 meters, that would be 7 megahertz. You're below the MUF. So you can kind of see from this chart what's open. There's reverse beacons. They've come back to life. They used to use Google Maps, and they started to charge for that. So then they went to a different solution, but you have to use their beta. It's in the bottom right corner here, beta.reversebeacon.net. And this works for CW and RIDI only. And so you can see if you start calling CQ, all these different stations have skimmer and they report back to the reverse beacon network. And you can see who's hearing you at that time. So that's a good tip for, I guess they're also into PSK now as well. So it's a good way of seeing and even comparing antennas. If you have antenna A and antenna B, you call CQ on one and then you move a little bit in frequency and you call CQ on the other, and you can compare these stations, their signal to noise ratio is listed here, and see which one's working better for you. This was last night at 10 p.m. on 15 meters. I was pointed with my TH6 Yagi at 40 feet, running 200 watts. I was pointed due north over the North Pole. And I'm being picked up in South America, in Europe, the coast, off the coast of Morocco, all over Japan, Eastern Europe and Asia and Australia. It was wide open. It was unbelievable. And it's only going to get better over the next couple of years. So in summary, we're in the steepest part of the ascent, cycle 25. Our solar minimum is best for the low bands. And so right now you're kind of going to be leaving those most of the time, and we're concentrating on 20 meters, let's say. Don't forget about sporadic E. I really didn't talk much about the E layer, but right now is sporadic E season. And yesterday I worked a lot of the East Coast states, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Maine, I've never worked before on 6 meters. I don't really have a 6 meter antenna. I use my work band dipole. It seems to load at 2:1 SWR, and I can put out 100 watts on FT8. And so that's what I was doing. Last solar maximum, I didn't know this, but I got on 10 meters and there were people operating near the top end of 10 meters on FM, and there were repeaters, and I was working Japan. It sounded like 2 meters. They were FM stations, and I was talking to some guy in his car as the 10 meter repeater was being retransmitted on 2 meters. So a lot of wild things can happen. Watch out for that. And also try QRP. If you're into portable operations with 10 meters, you don't need much of an antenna or a large antenna, 10 meters, half a wavelength is 5 meters. So it's easy to put up something quite short like that. But wait, there's more. I'm not giving away free steak knives, but there's a little bit of breaking news. This group under Scott McIntosh published an article in November of 2020, and they've got some new ideas that they've been putting forward. And we talk about, or they talk about, a termination event. It turns out that two cycles, so like cycle 24 and 25, overlap. And when they overlap, one cycle is not finished can affect the cycle that's just starting. And they tend to interfere with each other so that you remember the cycle or the slope of the curve from A to B starts off slowly and then rises quickly. Well, the reason it starts to rise quickly is because solar cycle, the previous solar cycle actually finishes up. It's over and can no longer subdue the next cycle. So that was their thesis here. And there's something called the butterfly effect. I don't want to talk about it too much, but as a cycle starts, the sunspots start up in the more northerly or southerly latitudes of the sun. And as the cycle progresses, they get closer and closer to the solar equator. And so that's what we're seeing here. And then finally, they noticed that cycle 25 started up about this point and or somewhere in here, that the terminator was really over here. So what that meant was really at the end of 2021, was when cycle 24 really ended. There was 2 years of overlap of both. And the reason they can tell is because the sunspots are of opposite magnetic field. So it's really a 22-year cycle, not 11, for one complete cycle. Whereas, so they look at the direction of rotation of these sunspots from their magnetic fields, and they see that one set is rotating opposite to the other. And so, now, at the end of 2021, things can really take off, and that's what we saw. So what they did was they said, okay, let's base this on 270 years of sunspot data, and they came up with a new prediction of a new peak of 190 sunspot units, solar flux units, plus or minus 20. What does that look like? Well, there's the past bunch of, this is 24, 23, 22, 21. So the 21 is that large, and then 23 is the medium, 24 is the small. They're saying their red curve here is probably where we're going to end up between 24 and 23. And it could go as high as even better than 23. My prediction with the 30% that I did in 2016 puts it around here, 156. NASA's is this blue curve on here, and I think we're already way above that. So again, I think we're going to see a really good peak to this cycle. So the second final slide is that we're doing well. We're outperforming the experts, and that. If you're not on HF, this is a good time to get an antenna. If you're, up, if you're in a condo or whatever, there's a lot of stealth antennas that would work on 10 meters or 12, 15 meters. You can get on FT8. Nobody will know about it. Check out magnetic, small magnetic loop antennas. Tell them it's a clothes dryer or something. You can make up a story if you want to put it on your balcony. I've just been doing a lot of research onto small magnetic loop antennas, and a 3 foot diameter antenna on 10, 12, 15 meters can be very effective. And you don't need radials or anything like that. And you can put out 50 watts on FT8 and work the world from your balcony sort of thing. So there's a lot of things you can do to get active and enjoy the next 2 to 4 years of the cycle. I think it's going to be really hot. With that, I will conclude, and we've got about a few minutes for questions. I think you have to go up to the laptop and ask a question. Otherwise, I don't think I'll hear you.
Got any questions?
The only thing I'm wondering about is if there's a way to get a copy of these slides.
Yeah, I will send a copy to the to whoever I need to, and they'll probably put out an announcement of some sort as to where you can find this.
Yeah, so the presentation's been recorded, and John, I think the plan's posted on the WARC website.
Yep.
So yeah, if you forward along the slide, we'll make sure that makes its way to the WARC website along with the presentation.
Yeah, you can come back in 5 years from now and see how wrong I was.
Yeah, we try to get Jerry on the regular WARC journal meetings every couple of years. And it's time, actually this is a good time, because I was thinking next year to ask you about this your solar presentation. So it's good timing for this. And Jerry's actually a really good presenter. He's got a lot of really interesting topics. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
Any more questions in the room? Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Jerry. It was very informative. And look, where I got to get my antenna back up now so I can get back on the HF bands myself. So. But yeah, thanks a lot for a good presentation.
Thank you very much.
All right, so we've got another hour and a bit, I guess, until up. Okay, I will see you back here at 1 o'clock.